what I learned from meeting Fred Frith and also Joël Leandre was you can't put anything between you and the music you want to create. There's no excuses between that, or there should be nothing in between. There can't be nothing in between you and the music you want to create. If there are, you have to go towards what you want.
Hello and welcome to episode 21 of Lo-Fi Podcast. I am John Wentz, recording conversations with artists, musicians, and filmmakers while injecting disinfectant and shining UV light into my body in Paris, France. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome to any new listeners. A couple of things before we get started. Again, this episode is brought to you by No Wave Academy. At nowaveacademy.com, you can view online workshops by some of today's best contemporary artists. They have workshops from artists such as Steve Kim, Sean Cheatham, Daniel Seagrove, myself, Mia Bergeron, and much, much more. So if you use this code at checkout, you can get 25% off on all online workshops. Discount code is NO-APRIL25, that's all caps, NOH-APRIL25, to get 25% off on all your online workshops. This is ending Thursday, April 30th at 11:59 p.m. PST. I am very, very excited to bring you today's episode. I have to say that even though the last 30 days plus have been a whirlwind of confusion, emotions, and uncertainty, I feel extremely lucky because these last two episodes have been conversations with two musicians who I greatly admire and whose music is among my favorite. The last episode was Robin Waddy from Big Brave. And in this episode, I'm really, really excited to bring you a conversation with Guro Skomsnismoe from Norway, who is involved with many projects, but primarily her band Moe, spelled M-O-E. I came across Moe only in the last year, but was, instantly taken by their like raucous energy, elements of noise, punk, and the growling vocals of Guro Moe, the frontwoman and bass player. After digging through the discography, I came to find that Guro not only plays the electric bass, but studied double bass and also plays an instrument called the octobass, and also works with a multitude of noise and experimental groups like Salt, the Touchables, and collaborates with other great sound artists such as Keiji Haino and Pain Jerk from Japan, just to name a few. In this episode, we talk about looking for different avenues amongst the coronavirus pandemic, her introduction to bass in an early age, the recording and writing process, and tons more. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you like the music you hear, please purchase the music. Spotify, again, is great for discovering bands, but as you'll hear even in this episode, it is pretty terrible for supporting bands. A lot of bands you can find on Bandcamp, and no sponsorship by Bandcamp whatsoever, but on May 1st, they're doing their second round of giving all proceeds to artists. I've purchased Moe's music on Bandcamp. I'll put links in the show notes. So on May 1st, if you buy any music on Bandcamp, all proceeds go to the artists. And I feel now more than ever, it's beyond important. Let's keep artists working. Let's keep musicians playing and support the things that we love. And without further delay, I am completely honored to bring you this conversation with Guro Moe.
Thunder, you see thunder, and you
So you're not in Oslo?
I am in Oslo now.
Oh, okay. Now
that's where I live. But we've I have a cabin outside of Oslo, just 40 minutes by car, which we've been driven to the 2 weeks before, or in for 2 weeks, just staying there to rehearse and record. Rehearsal spaces are so expensive.
Oh, so, okay.
So then in January, we just said we will not have a rehearsal space anymore because we were so busy this spring. So we would not be here until the summer.
Oh, man. You were supposed to be on tour for that long.
Yeah, and then work on project, the composition, and working with a puppet theater where we also will play as musicians. But the apartment, so then also the apartment is quite full of amps.
Oh, wow.
And,
jeez.
But it's what you do under more limited circumstances. It's a resistance, which I also can work with.
Yeah.
And the focus it has given me, and the extreme necessity of doing music just is more present.
Okay. So it highlights what you're doing.
Yeah.
Makes it even more important.
Oh, yeah.
What is it forced you to kind of refocus, but like, for instance, I just saw the other day you released a video, The Distant Basses, with Adriana Camacho.
Yeah.
So has this forced you to think in other ways of like collaborating and creating?
Also, since it's been very long since I spent this long time in the country where I live, and then realizing how much of my kind of grown-up professional self that has been created outside.
Oh, I see.
But that's another level to it. But which then the urge of collaborating, of new inputs from where I long to be, and where necessity of the out there collaborations, which were supposed to be, we were supposed to play together, we were supposed to have gotten all these other inputs, and then I kind of seek that from here, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And also, well, I also have a collaboration with a Mexican poet about, it's more of a writing collaboration.
Okay, you're going to be writing.
Yeah.
Not music, so you're doing, okay.
Or can turn out to music as well. It's just the thing we've been talking about. She found this book of, it's witch burnings from Inquisition time and then up until this 18th century, I bet.
Yeah.
From Mexico. And obviously there's also evidence and information and writings about that here as well. So we're just having a witch collaboration.
What's going to be the focus of it? Like, what's the intention behind it?
It's just an exercise, though.
Ah, okay.
We don't quite know. Experiment. But then something in this caught our attention when talking about it in Mexico. And then we're like, just... I get texts from her in Spanish. I write in Norwegian. Uh-huh. We just I found this online. I sent it to you, and somehow something is coming from it.
Yeah, you're really comfortable in that space of experimentation. Yeah,
that's been. I think if there's no resistance, I don't know where to put my energy. I need to, but I guess I've been also better in constructing resistance when it is not here. I find almost no resistance in Norway.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I feel so strange here.
Yeah.
And so many things I can't, like in terms of the, some things it's difficult to tell what it is, but just like, what is a life? What, how did you choose to live your life?
Yeah.
Here I've been, I found a way focusing on the material, like creating without looking too much around.
Uh-huh.
It sounds really perhaps negative.
No.
but obviously, or yeah, the thing with then working from here, and of course you see the naturalness of your community where you are, and then I've perhaps focused more on the community I have around in the world that led many places. to pull it back, and then also when you can't do the primarily force of everything for creating, is the energy created in a concert, in a live situation?
Yeah.
That's what makes me, and makes me have no second thoughts about anything of the hazardous work of booking, of traveling, of like exhausting hours. They don't matter. They have to be there for the sake of creating this presence in a concert.
Right. So that's your ultimate goal. End game is that live performance.
And now I must work on that with another patient.
Right. Okay.
And then I have found myself, all this, I don't know quite, the streaming concerts, it is good. People can play.
Yeah.
How could that then be? Make something that also can help us afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Like the necessity of live music. And like the kind of built perhaps of awareness of how actually difficult it also was before for venues to have money, like how the economy in music changes. And it's a risk in a way, doing music and having venues. And then making this time, because we have so much time and we can treat time in a different way. And then also the reflection is important in this time, I feel, for how to, like when it starts again, we can start from somewhere else. And
right. Oh no, go ahead. Yeah, no, that's perfect. I know it's weird because I was thinking that this morning that, you know, every day I wake up and it's the same thing now, and this has become the new normal, and it's not a good normal. And that thought really hit me the last few days of like, this is really, if you're to look at any positive turnout of this, is that it's a springboard for something new. Like you're saying, like in hindsight, okay, there was an old way. This is the new normal.
Yeah.
We can move forward in a different way, and especially in the arts.
Right? Oh, yeah. But that's, of course, that's, I guess, the scene where you've been the most adaptable and like using the unknown things that happens into your creative or process. Of course, every person has a different creative process, but then somehow it aligns with what is to create,
right?
To respond to your surroundings. Yeah. How then? I'm just thinking about that. How then? How can we make the change?
So, like I told you, it was within the last year that I came across Moe, and I was just completely blown away. And your music is amazing, and then delving more to your other projects. I mean, you really seem like one of the busiest musicians I think I've ever come across, or even beyond that, because you're doing writing, you did a book, you do fanzine.
it's so many desires for creating, and I guess because the input is really big, and I'm struggling with the output because it's so much. Not struggling, I'm just, it takes me more time, I think, to tell what I am because I need all this stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all a part of who you are.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't mind, I know some of these are, my whole thing with my podcast is, it's like I told you, it's just a general conversation. I try to avoid very basic things, but forgive me, cause I do want, cause I'm assuming most of my audience wouldn't be that familiar with your music. So I just want to pull back a little bit to where, when you got started on bass, you were quite young.
Yeah.
When you started. Yeah.
Where I had learned to play acoustic guitar by myself on this book that I had got. My family, or my dad, played flute, saxophone. It was a lot of like jazz music. He, from quite young, he also had, or when I was young, he also had the jazz clubs. But yeah, just as a start of my situation when growing up. But I got, it was just when I was 12 years, they needed a bass player for some school theater thing. And of course, I knew guitar. So bass is fairly simple, 4 strings. Yeah. So my dad bought me a bass. And then from that time, I just kept with it. It was, I played in rock bands in high school. One.
Yeah.
That's not bands, that's one. I had one band. But I was doing mostly dance and theater when growing up.
Okay. Did you go to an art school?
I did. Yeah. I said like from 16 to 19. What's that called?
For us in America, it's high school.
High school. So high school, I started in a theater, but I had to change to music after the first year because I felt I had to know music thoroughly. I just was no doubt, and I felt I could understand it on a level which I couldn't explain, and I just wanted to go for it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find, because the thing that's interesting about that is I play bass as well.
Yep.
And most bassists I know all started the same way. We all started as guitar players, but then nobody wanted to play bass, or nobody thought about it. So it's like, okay, fine, I'll play bass. And then you stick with it.
Yep.
But then I do know a small handful of bass players that were attracted to bass in particular.
Yeah.
Is very young. But in your case, like starting on guitar, do you think that, I don't want to say it's an advantage, but do you think that has a different outlook on the music in general? Because people I know that start with bass, everything is bass. Like they think in low frequency.
Yeah.
But sometimes I think people start with another instrument, go to bass, they see maybe a bigger picture or a different picture.
I think for me, it was such a short time span. It was 1 year with guitar and then I started bass. So I can't.
Oh, okay.
how did it stick with me? I think... because I was dancing, I had this other input towards creating and making sounds. I got this other input, and for such a long while, movements was what I thought of when I thought of sound. I pictured a movement in making a sound. But as I studied music and did more and more just music, that disappeared though. But then for such a long while, at least through high school and my next years, movements was how I came to make sounds. I started a group when I was 16, a duo with another girl. She's at the high school. She played vibraphone, and we created music which had no, it was no like basis like this, you have to play like that. It was very free. So I think the access to free improvisation came very early. So then, okay. And then more the, I think always this natural access to the just timbre and not bass as a bass. So when I, after high school, I went straight to a conservatory in south of Norway. And there my class was really into free jazz. And I had been experiencing that from the jazz club that both my sister and dad had. And I was always at those concerts. I had this eagerness towards being a part of everything that had with music from I was very young. Yeah. But the free jazz opened up the door to me wanting to play double bass, because all the music I listened to at that time at the conservatory had the contrabass.
Okay. Who were you listening to at the time? Do you know some of the artists?
I liked Scott LaFaro so much. That's not free jazz, though. But then, like, his playing in Bill Evans' trio was something so personal and so distinctly him, which resonated with me.
Yeah.
I didn't dig, like, the depth, but Mingus and Charlie Hayden, the Liberation Orchestra, I had quite a few records of. I listened a lot to Primus, but that's not a double bass. That was like Les Claypool.
Yeah. Well, back in the day, he was pretty. He was the hot bass player. Yeah.
And not that I laugh. I really like that. And then, but then came Henry Grimes, which came an obsession, and Peter Koval. I think they were the ones that I kind of stuck with in my further development. And also, I Joël Leandre, I got to know about very early, actually. Me and Joël have birthday on the same day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What day is that?
12th of September.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because I had lessons with her and come to know her. She is of my heroes.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So all through the conservatory, you're studying double bass.
Although I was not allowed because I was it was an electric bass study. So I was just fighting my teacher. Oh. It was quite.
There's that resistance again.
I had he just had to give up. He said, and
allow you.
Sure, I did my master's. No, my exam at the bachelor. I got the best grade. But I made, like, it was my own music. We had a trio called Art Directors, which was songs but improvised music, but then with electric bass and acoustic bass.
Oh, okay.
And then I got the best grade with the judge. Yeah, the judge said I didn't show any technical skill, so I should work on that.
That was the remark? You showed no technical skill?
Yeah, I should work on that. Okay.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
So, I'm kind of at a loss as how you would structure a free jazz program. Like, how does that work?
But then,
how
do you? This was purely on the basis of the students, not the school. The school is actually more a pop school.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, so this was just because of the students that was there.
And then?
And then this... This trio, Art Directors, we made it to the master program in Oslo for 2 years there. And that's an excellent program. They give us money. And
okay,
we choose to do which project we want.
Yeah.
And that's how we met Fred Frith. We had a project with him, which was
the guitar player, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. That and very interesting technique.
Yes, and his history and his involvement and importance of Henry Cow in the social aspects. his meeting him made me change, made my perception of being a musician change. Why are you doing this? Why this sound? He questioned, and then as going that many years studying and not having that question before, it felt the same with having a lesson with Joel. You feel stupid, or you kind of reveal your, or what I learned from meeting Fred Frith and also Joël Leandre was you can't put anything between you and the music you want to create. There's no excuses between that, or there should be nothing in between. There can't be nothing in between you and the music you want to create. If there are those, I don't know what you can call them, filters, or that's another kind of resistance. I have to go towards what you want.
Mm-hmm. What was your perspective before that?
I guess I had not allowed myself even to think I was a musician either. It took me a very long time I don't know what that came from the respect of the profession or the art or my position in the world.
Mm-hmm.
To respect myself is to respect the music, and you have to respect the music.
But you knew then, though, what it was, the kind of music you wanted to create. You had an idea, a trajectory.
I think it's been, the presence has been always so loud. So everything that's here, and also when doing, or but that came, of course, later after I quitted, the master's was done in 2007. And also already then we've been, touring came very naturally. And as yeah. the very important element for developing the music and but then you don't know in the beginning what drives you and why this is so necessary.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, it's also just you, because that's what you said you would do, and you put it. All energy and making impossible tours. As touring became the main element of like the structure of creating music, I think.
Oh, okay, the live performance,
yeah.
Like getting to the live performance. Yeah. And were you touring with art directors at that time?
Yeah, we did some in Norway. I think we did two tours in Europe, and then also Fred Frith invited us to play at the Stone when he was in 2007 or 6.
Yeah. Are there recordings of art directors? Because I couldn't find any. I've tried to track some down.
We have just like a CDR, which we have released, which is also with a DVD of our tour in Europe.
Is that on the Conrad Sound site?
It was before we started the label, just before we started the label.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I can send you if you want.
Yeah, I would love to. I would love to see that. Yeah, cool. And to hear that.
Yeah,
that's amazing. And that's 2007. So then, wasn't it 2008 when you started Moe?
Yeah.
So a year later.
Yeah.
And then that was. Was that Eyes Lies was the first?
Yeah.
Okay. So how do you transition? And now it's I'm sorry that because I'm talking out of ignorance because I don't know what art directors sounded like. So what was the transition to Moe?
It's like a pre-version. And then I think, or it's important, then also some other things at the master's study, meeting Else Olsen Storesund. She did a PhD program about open form, John Cage, focusing on John Cage, her PhD. And I was involved in her festival in 2006. And then seeing this way of how to challenge your mind for creating through the open form scores. Oh, yeah, Christian Wolf was also there at one of them, those festivals. But her, or what she opened up for me, was very crucial. And then, because in the master study, it's also just various forms of free music, seemingly free
yeah,
from your perspective. And then after the master, I've been slow in any kind of catching up with the music that has been made also. But then after the master study, I suddenly discovered No Wave.
Who were some of the first bands?
But I read a book about suicide. So they were...
Okay. Yeah.
And they... Something happened in me with reading about them. They're like someone holding on to their belief, their conception. That was helped me a lot. And then Lydia Lynch, I didn't read about her, like just this... not of her, but I just... tried to see. There's some books up here I read. The one with Joey Byron and sorry, the name forgot.
No, it's fine.
Different books I read. I read more than I listened. Did I? I think so. The idea of the necessity of creating that I could kind of sense in the time and the easiness of. That I can't tell just from reading, like the putting bands together, creating. It was a good time reading it for me. And then I felt that's how I got to the thought of having to start a band with more like putting the improvised or the strengths from improvised music and noise music into songs, into more structure and challenge myself in that way again, and also because I've written texts all the time and continuously making songs.
What are those, real quick, what are those challenges? Because you just said the challenges of improvised music and of like noise-based music. What are those challenges?
I don't think I said, did I say challenges? I meant or the challenges in...
Or strengths. Did you say strengths? Maybe
I think I said strengths.
Or the, yes, like yes,
the,
right. I'm
or
sorry.
The intuition, the immediacy, the non-hierarchical way of existence of sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
The non-intention, because that came to be like what I found how I could express myself. Was through the improvised music, but then getting this to from reading about DNA and Lydia Lynch and James Chance and listening, of course, also to them. I found finding the roots again from having a rock band since I was a kid early, young. Into how to manage to get this energy into rock songs. But then that was in the first version was then amazingly great improvisers. Saxophonist called Ole Jørgen Bardal and Børre Mølstad. Tuba player. He also did all the mixing. An amazing
guy. Yeah, yeah.
So it was like a... And then that became as a more structured version of the art directors.
And then it was a quite a bit of time in between that and then the longer release, right?
Sure.
It pictures. There was like 3-4 years or something in between.
Yeah. Then we decided to be just a trio. Although in the beginning there was no drummer either. But then we found... an amazing drummer in Sveinar Hoff that Håvard has studied with. That was that's like when you have songs on your first album, it's the songs you've been having since 20 years almost.
Uh-huh.
It's like kind of who are you? Is that
yeah, yeah.
Record of what is this?
Right. So that's kind of what I was hinting at. Was it that time because Eyes Lies was a two song album, and then so I wondered, like, in between there was this like long process of like figuring out what your writing process is, because there's a lot of music
yeah.
on it. Pictures. It, mm. You went from two to like it's some like 15 songs in there.
So it is
12.
Yeah. Is it that much? Wow. Strange to listen to that again.
Or 10 maybe.
Yeah. It was more the working out as everyday structure that also included the rock band. And also making those songs in between the booking and albums of other projects, like the collaborations we got in San Francisco. From being there the first time in 2007, Jacob Felix Hewley, which we have the band called Sult with.
Yeah, yeah, Sult is great. Yeah. I love that.
Thank you. We're just now working on new stuff.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Exciting. Cool.
We toured so much, like in the US and Europe, and sometimes we saw them more than we saw people here and played with. It was very intense at the points, which was also extremely crucial. That band has also been shaping me as a musician. Sult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In what way? Shaping you.
How we never deviated from what we did not know what we were up to. I was allowed then to push into something which I could not know and collectively. So then that trust that gives you.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
In like, at least at the time when this band was the most active, and then you're like just come out of school and what is it to be a musician? All like, it was crucial to me, that bass and how, you know, because I didn't, it sounds like I don't want to play bass kind of from playing Sult. I need that, not the diversity perhaps, but the trust in sound as just a state of mind, not the, it's just, yeah, just all these things that we discovered. It pictures, we didn't tour very much with that. I think we did one tour in Norway. And then...
With what? With Sult? Or no, with
It Pictures, yeah.
Okay.
And then the drummer quitted. And mm-hmm. then we did for about a year, we were drumless. And we played, I think we played, we had a gig at West Germany in Berlin.
Okay.
Which we did as a duo.
Just guitar and bass?
Yeah. And nice. Synth. Yeah, that was cool.
How was that for you at removing the drum? Because you got, and I would imagine too, because as a bass player, I don't know your process, but you know, bass and drums go together.
Yeah.
And you guys, your music is so rhythmically interesting.
Yeah.
Was it very different? I mean, that's a dumb way to put it.
Now also we've been without drums for a year. We also done duo concert a lot.
Oh, really? Where's it? You don't have your current drummer? I forget, isn't it Joachim?
Joachim, yeah.
Joachim, mm. Yeah.
I didn't know at the time, that time in 2011, it was just, we have a gig, we must do the gig. It was too much of a survival element and the presence, which I hadn't yet maneuvered to control. At that time, I just, obviously also since we have the experimental side in us is the strongest, is the most prominent. So it's not like this will be something for us, or for me, I don't feel this will be something completely different. It's the same in sounding with other timbres, other textures. Now though, having done duo concerts, I fully recognize this. The spectrum a drum both takes and gives to a band sound. the frequencies that are suddenly not there to push. And then how much I have to work, which I also enjoy. How can I produce that energy in, or how we produce this energy? But which I think we've found a way to.
And what, how?
In insisting, not just insisting, but it's as if it's more intense. Of course, it's very confronting having no drums. It's offensive, which I also enjoy. And I just jump also with the octobass in terms of what the eye thinks you're supposed to hear, and something else comes. I like that. What energy that takes out of the audience. I like, and I kind of search to get as well, because we're too slow in our, like, the concept or the eye ear connection, and we like,
okay,
we just I see what this is.
Are you filling up any of that space with do you have to use effects pedals or anything? Are you putting anything on the bass?
I have three pedals, which I use, but then now it's just more, it's so much more transparent, and it's required a very much difference. The compositions our songs have to be worked on much more.
Okay.
So then I'm a bit lazy with the pedals. So I'm like...
Lazy?
Yeah.
And what does that mean? They just don't like to use them?
Or I'm too easily satisfied with the sound.
Ah, okay.
And then, but now I have had to work more deeply in my sound, as also obviously extracting the potential of the duo situation, which then the depths and the dynamics especially.
Right. Yeah, it becomes much more transparent, I imagine.
But then I think also the dynamic aspect, that it's become more dynamic, has also helped our music in terms of it's quite confronting, or it requires something from the listener, and then somehow I'm curious towards our development now, or our evolvement, mm-hmm. in terms of allowing other aspects and other intensities.
Yeah. Do you plan to push through for a while just as a duo?
Or we have, it's kind of the different projects have led to us to work with other people, or we have been more working with Mette Rasmussen, the saxophonist.
Mm, yeah, I was going to ask about her.
That's just fucking brilliant.
I have to admit, selfishly, I was so disappointed to not see you in Paris. Oh, that was like one of my highlights of the month. And then the goddamn virus hit.
Can't it just stop for a weekend?
I know. And I was so excited for that. Hmm. Yeah, the sound. I've watched plenty of live performances, or the ones that you have on YouTube, of you playing as a trio.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me, the sound that the saxophone can fill.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't even know how to explain it. Cause it, like you're saying, I like that description of, like, my eye sees one thing and sets an expectation in my brain of what this is going to be. But once the music starts, it's completely shattered and I have to accept what it is now on new ground.
That's great. You know? So we did a tour in Japan.
Yeah.
And then we had no drummer.
Oh, you did the whole tour without the drummer.
Although, we played with 9 different drummers from Japan.
While you were there in Japan?
Yeah.
9? Oh, that's great. Yeah. How'd that work out?
It was, first it was, what the hell have we set ourselves up to do? But then from the first drummer, first he said he couldn't. He was a young, hardcore dude. He said he couldn't. But then the organizer of the gig said, well, he can play as because his wife told him to. So he had, but he was amazing. And then the that was like a study of interaction with drumming.
Mm-hmm.
As kind of the coolest was the guys who had no free jazz or like improvised background. If we said improvisation, they freaked out. But if we told them you're a team, then you're a team with Mette and you play like this, or like it's just this kind of energy. It felt, then it became just like this refreshing shower of having, and also this, what it did to us, how we had to accept nothing could be the same at any time. Like,
right.
And then accepting how that affected our sound together or our playing.
Mm-hmm.
But we did one or two trio concerts, and that was also, it was another force in us that almost got shocked from ourselves.
Right. What, and how were they doing it? Was were they playing, trying to play what was off the record? Did they study the albums and try and reproduce? Did they
some
make,
and also some which we've been playing, like the band Birushana and a band called Realized.
Uh-huh.
Birushana is from Osaka and Realized from Sapporo. Amazing bands. Gosh. Those drummers who are extremely fan of Joachim's playing, they had also like studied two or three songs from different albums, and they were like, they were taking the task very seriously.
Okay. Yeah, they knew it inside out.
Yeah.
Was that the same tour you did? You were joined by, I'm going to mispronounce his name, Kaiji Anno?
Yes, Kaiji Haino. Yeah.
Haino, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I saw one set that you guys did, and it was amazing. His energy, and now it makes more sense as you're describing it, because the energy. I can't remember what song that I'd seen him play on, but it really did add a different energy to it. And then also, I think he was playing. Was he playing a theremin at some point on tour?
But he has not. He didn't play with us, but he has that as well.
Okay, he didn't play a theremin with you guys.
I don't think so.
Okay.
He had his guitar.
It was hard to see because that this clip like a, I saw you were.
What's that called? I don't remember the name of the. It's like a Indian instrument, like a clarinet, but it's just exceptionally high, high dynamic. He played that.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. I'll have to look it over again. Yeah, I couldn't. There was just a weird sound that came at one of the choruses.
Yeah.
And I saw him move his hand down and over. So I assumed it was a theremin that he was playing. Oh. But who knows?
Yeah.
I'll have to watch it again. That was a clip. I think you look like you were wrapped in a bunch of tape. You were, out in the audience.
Oh, that's the one before. That's
different one.
Different tour a year before. We also played with him. Then we played. We opened for him. He played with his band. I will remember the name in short time. But then, because that's the band where he sings American classics.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So it's like a solo vocal. I will remember that too. He is...
no worries.
Yeah. But then to meet him, to hear him, to talk with him, that was something.
Yeah. Because I would imagine, I mean, he had, I don't want to say an influence, but I mean, you guys are in that same realm of experimental music. But so there's a mutual.
Him from like the 70s been, my gratefulness is then what his devotion gives to being a musician. And give, or to other people being a musician, and to the music, the importance of music.
Yeah, and it's amazing to see him continue. And even now, I see him pop up with like newer bands. Like he just did something with a Sumac.
Yeah.
And it was, I think American Dollar Bill was the record, and then they did some other things with him. And so it's so amazing to see his career. And he just pops his head up and does these amazing records with current bands and then continues his own thing. Yeah.
And so I did a record with him here in Norway. He wanted, or it's me playing the octobass and him on drum set.
What album is that?
It's not out yet. We're in the mixing of it.
That's exciting. Okay, good. And that's cool because I did want to talk to you about octobass too. So, yeah, please.
But I want to inform you that Mr. Heine wants to play drums. I'm excited to hear what that comes out as.
Yeah, so you haven't recorded yet?
We did last.
Oh, okay.
Or 18? September 2018. Just takes a while.
Yeah.
We have collaborations in Japan of importance. Is also with the Pain Jerk, Kohai Gomi.
Yeah. Pain Jerk's great.
Yeah. That's been, crucial.
Right. What was the last collaboration that you did with Pain Jerk on Moe?
Or he's a part, with Moe, it's
was he on Examination of the Eye of a Horse?
Examination of the Eye of a Horse. And but then we played, or Kohai Gomi was here in Norway in October 2018 and had a residency here. And he made a piece for him playing modular synth and then my chamber orchestra, the Touchables, with the octobass.
Yeah.
So we're just working on the mixing of that as well. It's called Dots Kinematic.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's exciting. Yeah. I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah.
Let's circle around then a little bit. Sorry, because there's so many things I want to talk about. We'll take a break from the records and just the octobass itself is phenomenal. And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this won't even know what the octobass is.
Nope.
How did you, because when I saw that, it reminded me of, because I'm a big fan of Harry Parch.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, and when I saw the video of that, I was like, wait a minute, like that, it reinforced that idea of searching for a sound or trying to, just the way he built his own instrument. Yeah. So I'm stumbling on my words, I'm getting too excited, but also that the bass being your instrument, it was just this beautiful thing of like trying to squeeze as much as you can out of a timbre and an instrument and a frequency. How did that come about with the octobass? Because there's very few of them.
It's nine in the world. This was the eighth. Now perhaps 10 as the orchestra in Montreal have one more.
Okay.
I think they'll have two or three. Why just have one?
Yeah, if you can have three.
Yeah. Of the history, it is a guy called Jean-Baptiste Viom who made it in 1850 something for the World Exhibition in Paris. So there's one at the University
here.
Museum in Paris. Well-known composers wrote for octobass. How I got to hear about it was through Ole Henrik Mo, the violinist who also has been playing on Mo records.
Okay. And did you do, I saw a video. Is he a very tall gentleman?
Yeah, the duo.
Ah, okay.
We did.
That video, I just have to say too, sorry, just as a little side note. Visually, that video is amazing because he is so tall.
Yeah.
And so thin, and then he's playing a smaller violin, and then you get on a stool to, or what is the instrument? It's not a violin, right?
It's called he calls it a piccoletto violin. I said it's even smaller than the one size below. That goes up to above 20,000 hertz, and the octobass goes down to 16. So it's quite we have a good spectrum.
Wow. Yeah, it's such a wide spectrum.
He started to talk about this octobass at the time when we made Left to Swallow, like the one-sided or laser-edged disc of Mo. That song I made, it was after the attack, the terror attack in Norway on the brutal destruction of our, or up until then, how we thought our how our society was built are quite naive. We're a bit naive, our country, I think.
You think?
Yeah. And then how this, yeah, even though that was a white man, it's strange how still, like, people talk and the race, the discrimination and the protectiveness have increased since then. That's very peculiar.
Yeah.
Well, perhaps yeah. not, but yeah. But nevertheless, then in that record, I wanted something that was just present, creating this uncomfortable feeling without hearing it. Then through a synth, and we was mm-hmm. that one we were recording at Lucky Cat Studio in San Francisco.
Oh, really? Yeah. You brought the Octobass from Norway?
No, but that was before. Oh. This was before.
Oh, okay, before. Sorry, I lost track there. Okay. I see what you're... Okay,
yeah, so then I was like... And then him talking about this instrument, an acoustic instrument that could create this sound. You couldn't hear it. You could just feel it. And I was, wow! I never heard about such a thing. And then I tried to find stuff about it. Of course, there were. And then by kind of just not from wanting one, but I asked the guy, it's called Wolfgang Stab, who I bought two double basses from, whether mm-hmm. he knew something about it, had heard or blah, blah, blah. But then he was just got so excited and wanted to build one. And then because I sometimes act very fast, not always, but then without mm-hmm. doing the reflection work, perhaps that should be before you said, yeah.
Like impulsive?
Let's, yeah, we're impulsive. Getting an Octobass. And then it all just, yes, we're getting an Octobass. And I remember calling him once time in the process saying, it feels so unreal to me. And just like from the other end, it feels very real to me.
Yeah.
But he made this amazing instrument. And he said, it's either 30, I think it's about 30 something centimeters bigger, the body. As he said, if it's shaped more like a violin
mm-hmm.
than the other octobasses, he found that would be better for the sound, like the resonance.
And how many meters is the entire instrument?
3.85.
Wow, that is huge.
Yeah. So we got it and had the composition I made together with Ul Henrik. So the first one with the touchables, our chamber orchestra, mm-hmm. at the festival called Only Connect in Oslo, which still feels quite unreal that happened. And then from that time, like our dreams for the bass, for the orchestra, has grown together with actual projects, like the mm-hmm. creating the duo album and the collaboration with Kohai, and also some concerts with the kids.
With kids? Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Ole Henrik composed a piece from a well-known Norwegian popular composer
uh-huh.
For this kids' string orchestra. Also a concert situation for all the schools in Oslo, where they came uh-huh. Think about seeing an octobass as a kid. How would that be?
It would be mind-blowing. And then to hear it, the sounds that thing produces is phenomenal.
Yeah, but we're at the moment on a very high gear for finding a place for the bass and the orchestra.
What do you mean by finding a place?
Buy a house. Also creating a bass residency center where also people could come. At the time in the future where people can travel.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really amazing.
Yeah.
So do you think at this point, like exploring that, the Octobass, and then what you're doing in Moe, do you have now an allegiance to the instrument, so to speak?
A
you know, is the bass your thing?
I know, perhaps this is how I am as well, like the kind of holding the sounds with the depth. That's something I like. Yeah, that's me. And the physicality of playing double bass, kind of, I guess then comes more towards the dancing. So it's like the movement. That's also is me. The electric bass. Sometimes I don't, what am I doing? Not what am I doing. I know what I'm doing. It's just like, it's not the main purpose. It's to express this sound.
Okay, yeah.
It's like an ingredient in a dish.
Okay, that makes sense.
So,
and it's interesting too, because don't you, with electric bass, you're playing a short scale, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I just think it's interesting because your octave bass, it's so huge. Yeah. Then you have the short scale electric bass, and then double bass.
Push the, I don't think it's boundaries, but it's to push the existence, or to open up through what you do. I think that's kind of more just like the more looks perhaps better on paper than saying or in saying it. But then this thing, how everyone has a mirror reflecting their reality,
right?
And then how from where you stand tells you what you see. And I feel like when creating, you can ideally, hopefully, help or make possible a wider view into that mirror.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. I like that.
Without it sounding Christian, it's very much just comes from yourself. Like, yeah.
I'm also curious, is I think in my, as like listening from an outside perspective, when I've listened to all your different musical recordings, I try to wrap my head around how you approach the music versus something like composing for octave bass or what you do in Sult, because it's so much more harnessed. Like you said, I don't even like for me, I don't even like to use the word structured, because I still feel like from a fan perspective or a listener perspective, it's like harnessing energy with Moe, like taking all those improvisational things that you do and then just kind of pulling it down into a song. Is it something like that? How do you approach the different projects?
Hopefully, or that would be the desired outcome in a way, or the different, it's kind of not looked upon so much as different. Oh, that's a lie. It is very different. but then how to just say it in words? It follows, in a way, many more like layers with Mo, with the creating of the songs. And they continue to change throughout playing them live. Not so much structurally, but the density, or the somehow obvious, but it's more challenging creating songs. It's like, it's not the same execution or of sound, or it's not to finding something that can endure the time, and it like, it'll just be better with playing it more and more.
Which is, it's the exact opposite of improvisation, obviously.
Somehow it's the ideal situation is that it has the exact same energy. It's as alive.
Oh, okay.
It's as alive as the improvised music. Not that improvised music always has this excellency, as I kind of put into it, but the possibility. So, but then also, that's also cool though. The songs have a very different nature, how they are to be created. And then,
right.
And that is like, just that everything somehow is alive. letting everything be alive. And then like one song, like stuff we're working on now, which will be the material for Oslo Janus number 5. That song's that's been there for forever. And I guess also that makes it possible with the time we have now. Now it's like, bring up all this stuff.
Is that why then, because didn't you, I can't remember correctly if it's up into like examination of the Eye of a Horse, like were you recording live?
Yeah, that's true.
In the studio? Yeah. Okay, up until then. Yeah. And was that part of the idea, is trying to capture that energy?
Sure. And it's kind of from perhaps like a bit puristic points of view, like that's what's
sure
the correct, and that's how the energy are supposed to be.
Yeah, because that's what live music is.
Captured. But then like, what different possibilities you have with the recorded material.
Yeah, because the studio becomes kind of like a part of the process, right? It becomes another tool.
Yeah.
In recording, yeah. in like a wider palette, yeah, so to speak, like for a painter.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And yet though, La Bufa again is more recorded live again. That's recorded in an excellent studio in León, in Mexico.
In Mexico.
Testa Studio. I would recommend everyone when they can travel to go there. He was worked as the helping out guy at the Steve Albini's.
Oh, really?
Electrical audio. Nice. And it's actually an exact copy.
Okay.
And I saw videos of Steve Albini from this record, or when he was there helping them out. And he was recording a mariachi band.
Cool. Yeah, that record sounds amazing, La Bufa. I love the sound of
it's
it. Yeah,
the Mexican inspiration.
Okay, and that was not your most recent, but that was back in October, right?
When but that's our
La Bufa was released.
La Bufa, yeah, that's insane how much Mexico has done for me, and I think also for the band.
I wanted to ask about that because you seem to have an affinity for Mexico. But I've seen some live performances and.
But that's
recording
since
there.
Our first tour, which was in 2013, then I was invited to a festival to play like an improvised music festival.
Okay.
But I found it natural to bring the band and that we did a tour. But then this energy we got from the Mexican audience, I had no idea that this was in our music or that this was possible. And how then the life that gave our songs, like a new soil for the songs, and how then, but that's since then also songs have been changing as to how a situation has been on tour or what you see or how the live situation is and the lyrics and the clashes of things. Ugh. And then suddenly the song is something else, or it means something else. And so because we went from that tour straight back and recorded the 3 album, and to me
the Oslo Janus,
and Oslo Janus, I can't think how we would have been or sounded without that intensity. It's in a way, I don't know if I'm then taking myself up too high, but it's like it's something same in our energies, in the Mexican people and our music. And then when we can, like, I have to kind of wrestle with the energy and work even more to dig out what's there in the potential. And then obviously cultures are different for a reason. Like we have salt and pepper in our food, not 60 something chilies and sun, and you can't as anything you can't predict also for my perspective, like this is how I want an audience to be. It's like different, everyone has their different ways, which is also part of how when you come there as kind of but then again I think that's the difference between bands coming there and like this is what we do, not that that's an bad in any of that, but then kind of giving them the right answer or giving or the participation. I bet there's always a participation when you're on a concert, but it's different elements of wanting the dialogue.
Do you think any of that reaction to, like, just because you're talking about culturally, like the cultural differences, any of that in any way has anything to do with, you know, that now they're witnessing a female fronted band, and use fronted in air quotes.
Yeah.
That's not something that's normal.
No.
Or I don't know if normal is right, not common.
I've gotten that question also before, and then when someone wondered whether that was a part of the reason for feeling, or that I could talk about having so many good experiences.
Uh-huh.
How could I answer to that? I have no clue about being anyone else in on one aspect. On that question that I got there, it's kind of more towards how being treated or how their reactions from, like, the people you play for, if that was much easier because people have, like, been having to fight so much with the venues and blah, blah, blah. Like, well, that's another level. Or how you perceive a situation, what you see in mm-hmm. what's in front of you and how you ask things. Perhaps that's different being a woman than being a man. And the expectations, again, what I expect in a situation, what other expects from what they think they see and what I think I see, that's more towards the element of organization. Towards mm-hmm. I definitely know it has meant something for other women in the places where we've visited, who have approached me after gigs and were very happy. And some, like in Mexico, being interviewed in a place, being confronted with the brutality, the violence against women, like killings, rapes, and being kidnapped. Then kind of saying a Mexican woman couldn't do what I am doing. And then, like, my necessity I need for my own life to play music is someone else's impossibility. I can't do anything else than what I do. And I'm every day I'm grateful that this is my life. And then as like the connection to Mexico, which also has been stronger and stronger. And then like our last, the La Bufa album also has an incident taken from such an episode in Mexico about the...
Was that Santa Rosa? Yeah.
And then in that context, all the interviews that we got being in Mexico, and just suddenly then I realized, what have I touched? What have I touched for them with saying this out loud? And they said, very few people, or of course there's organizations fighting and standing up for the violence against women. Mm-hmm. And then, but then the gratefulness they felt for someone else are talking about it. Not that that necessarily can make a change. And then, but then how, if you're not raising your voice, if no one raises their voice towards what they feel is wrong, how will our society look like in 100 or 200 years? What will be the essence of our... Then we just, after watching the press conference of Trump, we watched Idiocracy.
Same thing.
Who would have thought?
It's really scary how prophetic that movie was.
But every aspect of talking about injustice, I feel, just have to acknowledge that that's very important. And right. I can't kind of, and when I come back talking about it here, people just kind of want me to stop. Can't you just tell how good tacos you had? Or
I see. Yeah, they just want to.
Or the most important, how much money did you earn?
Oh man.
So, but that's like coming to back to our situation today. How I feel, it's just we're such a transparent. It's such transparent. The ones that are alone are more alone, and ones that has everything they need definitely has it. And the gap between now, like the ones working for the state and the ones working private. It's just it's so much things that pressure our humanity, or not pressure, but like challenges.
Yeah, that gap is just getting larger and larger. Yeah.
And then, of course, and I feel conflicted with the like talking about it with kind of you have to know your stuff before you open your mouth and talking about our society. But then again, how as being what I am, a musician, having my main inspiration and what drives me is the connection between people through music or art, and like this renewable, ever renewable source of energy. And in a way, I feel frightened for the situation, as how can you kind of get the reflection from the rest of the people to also acknowledge that you can do differently after this, and how do you, what you need, what you actually need, and that also art and music is a part of that.
A part of the need.
Yeah. Yeah. As the businesses that wants to start and make their money again on anyhow a model which didn't function as we were like, we need less. Everyone needs less. we jump at the same time down on the ladder of needs. That would be.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope that focus changes. Yeah. People realize the necessities, you know, but then that works for you. Like another thing that I love about that you guys are doing is then you have Conrad Sound, which is your own label. Mm-hmm. So you're finding your own way. Like you've done that from the beginning, your own way to put your music out there. And distribute.
Yeah.
Because you're handling both recording and distribution?
Yes. My partner, Hover, is doing most of the, like, the distribution part and managing the label. Me too, on the more, like, communication. In that sense, we have always been able to use it as, an important part of the creative outlet. Mm-hmm. As we have followed our own rhythm and strategy. It's not to put under a chair, a very good Norwegian expression, put under a tour, no, under a carpet, that it's like, what is distribution when in these days when, like, for instance, here, it costs more than the record sending it. Just these aspects of the how music can be available, but I think also that this time can be used for like making new platforms.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of that. I mean, of course, the discussions there, at least like where I'm dealing mostly with visual arts, that's a lot of the discussion right now is how to make these things available. What are the platforms after this?
Yep.
You know, what's the landscape going to look like? But it's nice that you have at least your digital platforms, like you have Bandcamp, Spotify is so-so for musicians, right?
It's very so-so. On this like level and being the musicians that we are, being having chosen this structure, it works shit, or it doesn't function. And then it's the thought, are we contributing? How is Spotify based and their like structure, how could that on any term actually be beneficial for a future aspect of earning money on your music? Every choice you do tells something about you, and then how I have resistance towards it on that aspect. It also comes, I haven't grasped what the potential is in the on this new thing, the internet. It's just important to respect yourself and fellow musicians. And I know I sound like a grandmother by not acknowledging that also, like, there's things in Spotify that, like, can be, could help the your visibility. And then it's more like taking the whole chart up, seeing how you want to communicate. But I know I'm not getting right. anywhere with my
no
this.
Yeah, I think it's tough. I think the thing with Spotify is the downside, it puts a responsibility on the listener, and that responsibility is to now go purchase the music from the band. Because the upside, I think, because I've been so back and forth with Spotify, but it was like, you know, maybe a year ago or something when they readjusted their algorithm. And I just know me personally, it's about exposure. Like, that's how I found your music.
Oh, yeah.
Was through the algorithm.
Okay.
But then the responsibility I find on the listener, and what I did is I go to Bandcamp wherever their music is, and I buy
it. Yeah.
And that's the rough part is getting that into people's head. And I hope, like, coming out of this that we're in, people are going to realize that, like, what I spend my money on makes a difference.
Sure. The incredible power you have as a consumer.
Yeah. And you know, and then on the downside, the thing that really scares me about things like Spotify, and not just in music, we see it in other platforms, is at some point in the last 2 years or so, we've entered this interesting era where we've forfeited ownership of things. Like, it's amazing to me that, like, because I don't buy vinyl anymore because I kind of went minimal, but like, that's my collection. These are physical things I own. And now people opt for a thing like Spotify where you don't own anything.
No.
You think you do because you follow these bands. But the second you can't pay that monthly subscription, you don't have shit.
Yeah, sure.
It's all gone. And we actively do that. Mm-hmm. It's insanity.
I haven't
when
thought
you think
about that so much, but yeah.
Isn't it weird? Yeah, a lot of things are, because I noticed that with apps, you know, for phones, everybody is going subscription based.
Yeah.
You know, even I work a lot digitally, so I use Photoshop, I use Illustrator. That's all subscription based.
Oh, yeah.
The second I can't afford that subscription, I can't work.
Yeah. But then, your stuff is gone.
Yeah, you can't work with it. You can't access.
Yeah, sure.
It's crazy how we'll forfeit ownership.
Yeah, that's something invisible
you
don't want to know of.
Yeah, yeah, precisely, yeah. But yeah, it is. It's interesting though. It is a freedom that we had now. Because I remember before, in buying records, there was a weird sense of not freedom, because to listen to it, you had to go purchase it.
Yeah.
But now that we have the option, people have forgotten that second part. Go support the artist.
Yeah.
Buy the music. Anyhow, I know you got a lot going on. I could talk for another hour and a half with you, but I don't want to take up too much of your time. But I really, really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank
out.
You very much.
So to end it, what do you have come up? So you have a couple of releases you were talking about.
There is fully mixed, soon mastered, a new Mo album, which is perhaps most pretentious album with the collaboration with Ole Henrik Mo, the violinist, and Kari Rønnekveil. They call themselves Sheriffs of Nothingness. They are amazing.
Nice.
And Anne-Marthe Sørlin Holen on percussion, and also Joachim on drums. And then it's just like, I hope it turns out, or I know how it sounds, but then we thought about it as a movie, and then it has allowed us new grounds to start from other, just new grounds.
Excellent. Yep. And so you have that, and then you have the collaboration with Kaiji.
Yeah, and then with Haino-san, and then a new coming up with Mette, released on an American label. And the next one with the Touchables, it's in full orchestra. It's the first piece called Svart-Hvit, Black White. What, and then this Oslo Janus 5.
Okay, that's all for the next year. That's what's coming out in 2020.
2020, and I bet some 2021. And I'm also working on solo recordings that I have from 2018 when I had the residency at Headland Center for the Arts in San Francisco. So
yeah,
and also a new sextet that I made January called Guru Dynamo Revolution Sextet with Vivian Wang, Cheryl Ong, Danishta Rivero, Sandy Bushman Roman, and Anna-Marthe Sørlin Holen.
When will that be out?
So I think it's out sometime this year.
Okay, yeah. Excellent. Great. Again, though, I do really want to thank you because finding your music in the last year was one of the highlights of my year.
Thank you.
So thank you for doing what you do. It's amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It gives a lot.
All right.
Bye.